For every vice, Philopappus, must be fled by way of virtue, not by way of the opposite vice, as some seem to think, fleeing bashfulness by shamelessness and boorishness by buffoonery, while placing their character as far as possible from cowardice and softness, so that they appear very close to recklessness and rashness. Some also make of atheism and unscrupulousness an excuse for escaping superstition and folly, twisting their character, like a piece of wood bent the wrong way, from one crooked extreme to the opposite, one out of an experience in setting it straight. And the most shameful renunciation of flattery is to be needlessly unpleasant, and, out of sheer tastelessness and lack of skill in dealing kindly with people, to flee, through mere disagreeableness and harshness, what is ignoble and servile in friendship. Like the freedman in comedy who thinks that giving offense is the enjoyment of free speech. Since then, it is shameful to fall into flattery by pursuing what is pleasing, and shameful also, in fleeing flattery, to destroy what is friendly and caring through an excess of frankness. And one must suffer neither fault, but, as with anything else, draw from frank speech what is good by way of moderation. The argument itself, in demanding what comes next, seems to be putting the finishing touch to our essay. So then, seeing that there are, as it were, a good many banes attached to frank speech, let us first remove from it self-love, being very much on guard lest, on account of some private matter, feeling wronged and pained, say, we seem to be reproaching our friend. For people suppose that the speech made on behalf of the speaker himself arises not from goodwill but from anger, and that it is not admonition but complaint. For frank speech is a mark of friendship and dignity, while complaint is self-regarding and petty. Hence people respect and admire those who speak frankly, but return the charge against, and despise those who merely complain, just as Agamemnon could not tolerate Achilles, who seemed to speak with moderate frankness, yet yielded to and endured Odysseus, though he attacked him bitterly, saying, "Accursed one, would that you were commanding some other inglorious army," restraining himself before the caring and sensible character of the speech. For Odysseus, having no private grievance of his own, spoke frankly to him on behalf of Greece, whereas the other seemed to be angry chiefly on his own account. As for Achilles himself, though he was no sweet-tempered or gentle man, but a formidable one, of the kind who could make even an innocent man feel blamed, he allowed Patroclus in silence to heap up many such reproaches against him as pitiless one. "Surely then your father was not the horseman Peleus, nor Thetis your mother. Rather the gray sea bore you, and the sheer cliffs, since your mind is so unyielding." For just as Hyperides the orator thought the Athenians should consider not only whether a man is harsh, but whether he is harsh gratis, without personal stake, so too the admonition of a friend, when it is free of all private feeling, commands respect, dignity, and cannot be met with a defiant stare. But if someone, in the very act of speaking frankly, is plainly seen to pass over and leave entirely aside the wrongs his friend has done to him personally, while exposing and censuring, without sparing him, certain other faults committed against others, the force of such frank speech is irresistible. And by the sweetness of the one giving admonition, he only intensifies the sharpness and severity of the reproof. Hence it has been well said that in anger and in disputes with friends one ought especially to do and consider something for their advantage or propriety. But no less a mark of friendship than this is to speak frankly and to remind people, on behalf of others who are being neglected, of the very fact that they themselves seem to be overlooked and disregarded. So Plato acted in his dealings with Dionysius amid suspicions and disputes. He asked for a time to meet him privately. Dionysius granted it, supposing that Plato had some complaint of his own to lodge and explain. But Plato addressed him something like this: "If you perceived, Dionysius, that some ill-disposed man had sailed to Sicily wishing to do you some harm, but lacking opportunity, would you let him sail away and allow him to depart unpunished?" "Far from it," said Dionysius, "Plato, for one must hate and punish not only the deeds of enemies but their intentions too." "Well then," said Plato, "if someone has come here out of goodwill toward you, wishing to be the cause of some good for you, but you afford him no opportunity, is it right to let him go away thanklessly and with neglect?" When Dionysius asked who this man was, Plato said, "Aeschines, a man whose character is as decent as that of any of Socrates' companions, and whose speech is capable of improving those who keep his company, and having sailed here over a great expanse of sea, in order to associate with you through philosophy, he has been neglected. This so moved Dionysius that he immediately threw his arms around Plato and embraced him, admiring his kindness and magnanimity, and saw to it that Aeschines was cared for handsomely and generously. In the second place, then, let us purge frank speech, as it were, of all insolence, mockery, jeering, and buffoonery, vicious seasonings of frankness. For just as when a doctor cuts flesh, a certain rhythm and cleanliness must attend his work, while a dancer's flourish, recklessness, roving suppleness, and fussiness must be absent from the hand, so too frank speech admits of wit and cleverness, provided the charm preserves its dignity. But insolence, foulness, and outrage, when they attach themselves to it, utterly corrupt and destroy it. Hence the lyre player, not without persuasiveness or tact, silenced Philip when he tried to argue with him about points of music, saying, "God forbid, O king, that you should ever fare so badly as to know these things better than I do." Epicharmus, however, spoke wrongly when, after Hiero had put some of his acquaintances to death, and a few days later invited him to dinner, he said, "But the other day, when you were sacrificing, you did not invite your friends." Antiphon, too, spoke badly when, in a discussion at Dionysius' court about what bronze is best, he said, "That from which they made at Athens the statues of Harmodius and Aristogiton." For such remarks neither help by their sharpness and bitterness, nor please by their buffoonish playfulness, but are rather a kind of licentiousness mixed with malice and hostility, a sort by which those who use it destroy themselves as well, literally dancing the dance around the well's edge. Indeed, Antiphon was put to death by Dionysius, and Timagenes was cast out of Caesar's friendship, though he never used free speech, but at drinking parties and walks, on every occasion, without any serious purpose, kept bringing up, as though it were a clever jibe, whatever occurred to him as a laughing matter, a cause of friendship for the Argives. For even the comic poets composed much that was harsh and political for their theater audiences, but the laughable and buffoonish element mixed into it, like a bad relish added to food, made their frankness ineffective and useless, so that its speakers gained a reputation for malice and foulness, while their hearers gained nothing useful from what was said. In general, then, playfulness and laughter must be brought to friends in one manner, but frank speech must have seriousness and character. And if it concerns weightier matters, the speech must be made credible and moving by feeling, posture, and tone of voice. An occasion, when neglected in anything, does great harm, but it especially ruins the usefulness of frank speech. That such frankness must be guarded against in wine and drunkenness is entirely clear. For he who stirs up talk amid play and friendliness brings a cloud upon a clear sky, drawing up the brow and composing the face into a scowl, as though setting himself against the god Laius and against him who looses the brow's furrow of hard cares, as Pindar says. And ill-timedness in this carries great danger besides. For souls are especially prone to anger on account of wine, and often drunkenness, seizing upon frank speech, has turned it into enmity. And in general, it is neither noble nor courageous, but rather unmanly, to indulge in frank speech at the table when sober silence would have been more frank, like cowardly dogs. There is no need, then, to dwell at length on these matters. But since many people, when their friends are faring well in their affairs, neither think it right nor dare to correct them, but consider good fortune wholly inaccessible and unreachable by admonition. Yet when those same friends stumble and trip, they set upon them and trample them underfoot once they have been brought low, releasing upon them, all at once and against nature, like a stream that had been dammed up, their frank speech, and gladly enjoying the change on account of their former disdain for those men's arrogance and their own former weakness. It is no worse to go through this matter too, and to answer Euripides, who says, "When the god gives good things, what need is there of friends?" That it is precisely when friends are prospering that they most need frank-speaking friends, ones who will restrain their excess of pride. For few are those to whom good sense comes along with good fortune. Most people need borrowed wits and outside reasoning to press upon them, since they are being puffed up and tossed about by fortune. But when the god casts down and strips away their pretension, In the very circumstances themselves lies the power to admonish and to instill repentance. Hence there is then no need of a friend's frank speech, nor of words carrying weight and sting, but truly, in such reversals, it is sweet to look into the eyes of a kindly light that comforts and encourages, just as Xenophon says that Clearchus' face, seen amid battles and dangers, being kindly and humane, made those in danger more confident. But the man who brings frank speech and biting words to someone in misfortune, like a sharp probe to an eye already troubled and inflamed, heals nothing and removes nothing of what is causing pain, but adds anger to grief and further provokes the sufferer. For instance, a man in good health is not harsh or altogether savage toward a friend who criticizes his drinking bouts and companions, or criticizes his idleness, lack of exercise, constant bathing, and untimely overindulgence. But a man who is sick cannot bear it. It is a greater sickness still to hear that these things have happened to him from intemperance and softness, and from delicacies and women. Oh, what bad timing, man! I am writing my will, and my doctors are preparing castor oil or scammony for me, and you are moralizing and philosophizing at me. So too the affairs of the unfortunate do not admit of frank speech and moralizing, but need gentleness and help. For nurses too, when children fall down, do not run up to scold them, but lift them, wash them off, and set them right, and only then do they rebuke and punish them. It is said too that Demetrius of Phalerum, when he had been driven from his country and was living near Thebes in disgrace and low circumstances, was not glad to see Crates approaching, expecting cynic frankness and harsh words. But when Crates met him gently and spoke with him about exile, saying that it held nothing bad, nor anything worth taking hard, since he had been freed from precarious and unstable affairs, and at the same time urging him to take courage in himself and in his own disposition, Demetrius, growing more cheerful and regaining his confidence, said to his friends, "Alas for those activities and preoccupations, on account of which I never came to know such a man as this. For to one who is grieving, a kindly tale from friends is fitting, but admonitions are for one who is behaving too foolishly. This is the way of noble friends, but the ignoble and lowly are flatterers of the fortunate, who, as Demosthenes says of ruptures and sprains, are stirred up whenever some illness seizes the body. Such men fasten upon reversals of fortune, as though delighting and taking pleasure in them. And indeed, if he should need some reminder in matters where he stumbled through his own poor judgment, it is enough to say, 'Not at all according to our mind, for I indeed strongly advised against it many times.' In what circumstances, then, must a friend be forceful, and when should he use the full intensity of frank speech? When the occasions call for checking someone carried away by pleasure, anger, or arrogance, either to curb greed, or when it would be senseless to tolerate carelessness." So Solon spoke frankly to Croesus, who had been corrupted and made soft by unstable good fortune, bidding him look to the end. So Socrates used to check Alcibiades, and drew from him genuine tears when he was refuted and turned his heart around. Such too were the words of Cyrus to Cyaxares, and those of Plato to Dion, at the time when Dion was at the height of his brilliance and was turning all men's eyes upon himself because of the splendor and greatness of his deeds, Plato urging him to guard against and fear self-will, since it dwells with solitude. Speusippus too wrote to him not to be proud that he had great repute among boys and women, but to see to it that, by adorning Sicily with piety, justice, and the best laws, he would bring renown to the academy. Euctus and Iulius, companions of Perseus, always spoke to please him and nodded agreement while he was fortunate, following along like the rest. But when he had engaged the Romans at Pydna, stumbled and fled, they fell upon him and reproached him bitterly, reminding him of the wrongs he had done or overlooked, casting up each one to him, until the man, overcome with grief and anger, struck them both down with his dagger and killed them. Let the occasion common to all cases, then, be marked out in this way. But the occasions that people themselves frequently provide, a friend who truly cares for them ought not to let pass, but should make use of. For a question, or a narration, or blame of similar faults committed by others, or praise, serve as a kind of opening for frank speech in some cases. For example, they say that Demaratus came to Macedonia at the time when Philip was at odds with his wife and son, And when Philip greeted him and asked how the Greeks stood toward one another in Concord, Demaratus, being well disposed toward him and on familiar terms, said, "It is indeed a fine thing for you, Philip, to be inquiring about the Concord of the Athenians and the Peloponnesians, while you overlook your own household, embroiled in so great a discord." Full of strife and discord. Diogenes too spoke well. When he came into Philip's camp, at the time Philip was marching out to fight the Greeks, he was brought before him, and Philip, not recognizing him, asked whether he was a spy. "Certainly," he said, "a spy, Philip, of your poor judgment and folly, on account of which, with no one forcing you, you come to gamble away your kingdom and your life in a single hour." This, perhaps, was rather too harsh. But there is another occasion for admonition. Whenever people, reviled by others for the faults they commit, become humbled and subdued. A tactful man would make skillful use of such an occasion, checking and deflecting those who revile, while privately taking his friend aside and reminding him that, if for no other reason, he should attend to the matter so that his enemies not be emboldened. For where will they find room to open their mouths? What will they have left to say, if you let this go and cast off the very things for which you are spoken ill of? In this way the pain becomes the reviler's and the benefit the admonisher's. Some manage this more cleverly. By finding fault with others, they turn their own acquaintances around, since they accuse other people of doing the very things they know their friends are doing. Our own teacher Ammonius, during an afternoon class, on noticing that some of his students had eaten an extravagant lunch, ordered his son's freedman to give his own boy a beating, adding that the boy could not lunch without a dash of vinegar. And at the same time he looked toward us, so that the reproof landed on those who were actually guilty. Further, one must be cautious about using frankness with a friend on many occasions, bearing Plato's remark in mind. For when Socrates had taken one of his companions to task rather sharply while conversing at table, Plato said, "Would it not have been better to say this privately?" And Socrates replied, "And would you not have done better to say this to me privately?" And they say that when Pythagoras treated an acquaintance rather roughly in front of many people, the young man hanged himself, and from that time on Pythagoras never again admonished anyone in the presence of another. For, like a disease that is not decent to expose, the admonition and uncovering of a fault must be kept private, not turned into a public festival or a display, nor made to gather witnesses and spectators. It is not the mark of a friend, but of a sophist to build a reputation on other people's errors, preening himself before the bystanders, like those doctors who perform surgery in the theaters for a fee. But apart from the insolence which it is right that no course of treatment should carry, one must also consider that vice is quarrelsome and stubborn. For, as Euripides says, love does not press harder simply because it is admonished plainly. Rather, if someone admonishes without restraint and before many witnesses, he drives every disease and every passion into shamelessness. Just as Plato holds that those who would instill a sense of shame in the young must themselves, as old men, first feel shame before the young, so too among friends the frankness that itself shows restraint is the frankness that abashes most effectively. And approaching the offender gently and cautiously, taking hold of him with care, undermines and works upon the vice, filling it with shame at the very shame it meets. Hence it is best to hold one's head close, so that others may not overhear. And it is least fitting to expose a husband with his wife listening, a father with his children looking on, a lover with his beloved present, or a teacher with his acquaintances present. For people, refuted before those in whose eyes they wish to have a good name, are driven beside themselves by pain and anger. I think too that Cleitus was provoked less by the wine than by the fact that, with many looking on, he seemed to be cutting Alexander down. And Aristomenes, Ptolemy's tutor, gave the flatterers a handle against him because he struck the king to wake him when he was nodding off during an audience with ambassadors. They pretended to be indignant on the king's behalf and said, "If you were so overcome by toil and lack of sleep, we ought to have admonished you privately, not laid hands on you in front of so many people." And so he sent the man a cup of poison and ordered him to drink it down. Aristophanes says that this too was the charge brought against Cleon, that with foreigners present, he spoke ill of the city and provoked the Athenians. For this reason, those who wish to use frankness usefully and therapeutically rather than to make a display of it or curry favor with a crowd, must guard against this as well, along with everything else. And indeed, what Thucydides has the Corinthians say of themselves, that they deserve to bring reproach upon others, a remark well made ought to hold true of those who speak frankly. Lysander, it seems, said to the man from Megara who was speaking frankly among the allies on Greece's behalf, that his words needed a city behind them. But frankness, perhaps, needs the backing of a man's whole character. And this is truest of all when said of those who admonish and bring others to their senses. Plato, at any rate, used to say that he admonished Speusippus simply by the example of his own life, just as Xenocrates, merely by being seen in the school and turning his gaze on Polemo, converted and transformed him. But it is the mark of a shallow and worthless character for a man who takes up the language of frankness to have it said of him, in addition, that he is himself a healer teeming with other sores. Nevertheless, since men who are themselves flawed and who keep company with others of the same kind are often driven by circumstance to admonish, the most reasonable approach is the one that links the frank speaker himself, in some way, to the very fault he charges, the sort of thing meant by son of Tydeus, what has come over us, that we have forgotten our furious valor. And now we are not worth even a single hector. Socrates too used to refute the young so gently, not as one already free of ignorance, but as one who thought he needed, together with them, to pursue virtue and seek the truth. For those who fall into the same faults, and yet think they are correcting their friends as they would correct themselves, win goodwill and trust. Whereas the man who exalts himself while cutting another down, as though he alone were pure and untouched by passion. Unless he is well advanced in years or has an acknowledged reputation for virtue and standing, only comes across as burdensome and oppressive, and does no good. Hence Phoenix did not simply relate his own misfortunes at random, how in anger he had once tried to kill his father and quickly repented, lest I be called a father killer among the Achaeans, but did so precisely so as not to seem to be admonishing Achilles as one himself untouched by anger and free of fault. For such things work on people morally, and men yield more readily to those who seem to share their affliction than to those who look down on them. And since one must not bring a bright light to an inflamed eye, nor can a soul in the grip of passion accept frankness and unmixed admonition, one of the most useful remedies is a touch of praise mixed in, as in these lines. But you, no longer let go your furious might, you who are the best men in the whole army. I would not fight with a man who let go of war being a coward, but I am angry at heart with you too, Pandarus. Where is your bow and your winged arrows and the fame in which no man here can rival you? And still more openly Homer calls back to themselves those who are slipping, as when he has one say, Oedipus, where now are your famous riddles? And another, this is the speech of Heracles, who has endured much. For such words not only relieve the harshness and sting of blame, but also instill in the shamed man a rivalry with his own better self, by reminding him of his noble deeds and making himself his own model for something better. But whenever we set others beside him, his peers, say, or fellow citizens or kinsmen, the contentiousness of his vice grows resentful and savage, and this often provokes the angry retort. Why then don't you go off to those better than I am, instead of giving me trouble? One must therefore be careful about praising others when speaking frankly to someone, unless, of course, they happen to be his parents, as when Agamemnon says, truly Tydeus begot a son little like himself. And as the Odysseus of the Syrians says, you who disgrace the bright light of your lineage, spinning wool, though born of the noblest of the Greeks. Such comparisons are not fitting elsewhere. It is least fitting of all for a man being admonished to counter-admonish in turn, answering frankness with frankness. For this quickly inflames matters and breeds a quarrel, and altogether such pushing back looks not like a reply in kind, but like a man who simply cannot bear frankness at all. It is better, then, to put up with the friend who seems to be admonishing. For if he himself later goes wrong and needs admonition, this very fact gives, in a sense, license to one's own frankness in return. For being reminded, without any bitterness, that he too used to refuse to overlook his friend's faults but would expose and instruct them, he will yield more readily and accept the correction, since it will seem a repayment of goodwill and gratitude rather than of blame or anger. Further, Thucydides says, Whoever takes on the envy that attaches to the greatest matters plans rightly. And it is fitting for a friend to bear the odium that comes from admonishing when the matters at stake are great and truly important. But if he is difficult about everything and with everyone, and treats his companions not as a friend, but as a schoolmaster, he will be blunted and ineffective when admonishing in matters of real weight, like a doctor who has spent a sharp or bitter medicine on many trivial and unnecessary things, and so has none left for what is truly necessary, having used up his frankness on it. He himself, then, will be very careful to avoid constant fault-finding. But if someone else is petty about everything and prone to false accusation, this will serve him, as it were, as an opening for the more serious faults. Indeed, the physician Philotimus, when a man with an abscessed liver showed him his ulcerated finger, said, "My good man, this is no time to talk about hangnails." So too, the occasion gives a friend the chance to say to one who complains about small and worthless matters, "Why do we speak of games and drinking parties and trifles? Let the man, my good sir, get rid of his mistress or stop gambling, and in every other respect, he is a marvelous fellow as far as we are concerned." For the man who has received indulgence in small things does not find it unpleasant to grant his friend frankness in greater ones. Whereas the man who is forever harping on everything, everywhere and always bitter and joyless, knowing everything and meddling in everything, is unbearable even to his own children or brothers, and indeed insufferable even to his slaves. And since, as Euripides says, not every evil belongs to old age, nor does every evil belong to the folly of friends, one must watch one's friends not only when they err but also when they succeed, and, by Zeus, be eager to praise first. Then, just as iron is hardened by cooling and takes its temper only after first being softened by heat, so with friends. When they are relaxed and warmed by praise, one should apply frankness gently, like a tempering. For the occasion allows one to say, "Is it really worth setting that beside this? Do you see what fine fruit nobility yields? This is what we, your friends, require of you. This is what truly belongs to you. For this you were born, but those other things must be cast off, to the mountain, or into the waves of the loud-roaring sea." For just as a sensible doctor would rather resolve a patient's illness by sleep and diet than by castor oil and scammony, so too a reasonable friend, a good father, and a teacher take more pleasure in using praise than blame for the correction of character. For nothing else pains the man being spoken to frankly so little, and heals him so much, as the sparing of anger and an approach made with good character and goodwill toward those who err. Hence one must neither harshly refute those who deny their fault, nor prevent those who wish to make their defense, but must somehow help supply decent excuses too. And, as people draw back from the worst charge on their own, allow them a milder one, as Hector does. Strange man, do not harbor this anger in your heart, toward his brother, treating his withdrawal from the battle not as flight or cowardice, but as the result of anger. And Nestor says to Agamemnon, "But you yielded to your great-hearted spirit. For I think it more considerate to say, you did not attend to it, and you were unaware, than you did wrong, and you behaved shamefully. And to say, do not quarrel with your brother, rather than do not envy your brother, and flee the woman who is ruining you, rather than stop being ruined by the woman." For this is the manner that therapeutic frankness seeks, while practical frankness seeks the opposite. For whenever it is necessary to check people who are about to go wrong, standing against some violent impulse carrying them the wrong way, or to urge on and stir those who are soft and reluctant toward noble action, one must attribute what is happening to strange and inappropriate causes, as Odysseus does in Sophocles, provoking Achilles. He does not say that Achilles is angry over the dinner, but says instead, "Are you afraid, now that you see the seats of Troy before you?" And again, when Achilles grows indignant at this and says he will sail away, Odysseus replies, "I know what you are fleeing, not the fear of being spoken ill of, but because Hector is near, it is not good to stay." The man, then, who is spirited and manly, they frighten with the prospect of a reputation for cowardice. The one who is moderate and well-ordered, with a reputation for licentiousness. The one who is generous and magnanimous, with a reputation for stinginess and love of money, thereby urging him on toward noble conduct and driving him away from disgrace. Moderate when dealing with irreversible matters, showing more of the pain of shared suffering than of blame in their frank speech, but vehement, relentless, and persistent in checking faults still in progress and in struggles against the passions. For this is the occasion for goodwill that holds nothing back and for genuine frankness. But we observe enemies employing the practice of finding fault with each other's actions. Just as Diogenes used to say that a man who is to be saved needs either good friends or fiery enemies, since the one kind instructs while the other refutes. It is better, though, to guard against faults by heeding those who advise us than to repent of a fault because of those who speak ill of us. And for this reason, one must cultivate real skill even in frankness, since it is the greatest and most powerful remedy in friendship, and always requires good aim in timing together with a measured blend. Since then, as has been said, frankness is often by nature painful to the one being treated, one must imitate physicians. For they, too, when cutting, do not leave the affected part in pain and suffering, but bathe it gently and soothe it with washes. Likewise, those who admonish skillfully do not, after inflicting something bitter and cutting, simply walk away, but with other kinds of conversation and reasonable words, they soften and dissolve the sting, just as stone carvers, after chipping and cutting their statues, smooth and polish them afterward. But the man who has been struck by frankness and marked by it, if left while still rough, swollen, and disturbed by anger, is again hard to call back and hard to console. For this reason, those who admonish must especially guard against this too. Not to leave too soon, and not to make the pain and irritation of their companion the very point at which they end the conversation and the meeting.